Welcome to the Service Course Report. My name is Ed Philbrick. I'm joined by Kurt and Darren Stockton. We're about to record episode 6. We're making tremendous progress. We appreciate all the likes, support, sharing, and the growing of our following. Just a reminder, quick reminder, that if you want to see us on video, you can watch us on YouTube and Spotify. But if you're on Apple Podcasts, you won't see video just yet. Apple hasn't quite embraced video on their podcast network. So just a quick introduction to who we are. Kurt, you want to start off?
Yeah, Kurt Stockton. Been friends with these guys most of my life, at least the dude in the blue shirt, since this is my younger brother, Darren. Three of us grew up together on the central coast of California, Santa Barbara. Got into riding bikes right about when we met in the early 80s, and have made a career out of cycling, whether it was racing road bikes or mountain bikes, or getting involved in marketing, working in the industry. So just we're really enjoying sharing all of the decades and decades of experience we have and telling stories and, you know, what's old is new and what's new is old, and hopefully imparting a little bit of wisdom.
Yeah. DS. And I'm Darren Stockton, and I'm a former professional road and downhill mountain bike racer, woke up downhill mountain bike racer, longtime industry veteran. I've worked a lot in product design in the bike industry, mountain bike tires, designed for Maxxis and Tents, and currently Panaracer tires. And I also worked as a trainer in the sport of professional motocross, and still do at times, but that was my main main job for about a decade.
Right on. I'm Ed Philbrick. I've raced all the bikes. We raced cyclocross. We raced a little bit of mountain bike. We raced the track. I grew up racing bikes with these guys. I'm a realtor on a bike. I specialize in helping people find homes in the Western United States or anywhere where cycling is a hub, where you want to live on a trail. I know a realtor in Bend, Oregon that can help you live right on a trail. So it's a little bit of who we are. And maybe just to give us a little more flavor and color, what kind of rides did you guys do last weekend, or what rides do you have planned for the holiday weekend?
I got out. I've been on my gravel bike. I haven't had a lot of long time to ride, so I've just been doing short loops out on the Carp Bluffs here from my shop in downtown Carpinteria, and have some tire testing I've been doing for Panaracer. And so I've been doing some comparison testing. And so those have been most of my rides, mostly Carp Bluffs and Fast and Furious. And for this coming Labor Day weekend, hoping to get out on the electric mountain bike, get up to the top of the mountain. I haven't done that in a little while. And so hopefully get in a good gravel ride and a good mountain bike ride over the coming weekend.
Nice.
Yeah.
What do you got planned, Ed?
Let's see. Tomorrow is the Thug Ride. The Thug Ride is hilarious. I think it's named after Doug Pomerantz, who's like probably in his early 60s, but he's just one of the local hammers. And so he always puts on the Thug Ride. Chris Horner would be on it if he was in town. I will do the Sidewinder Thug Ride, which means wherever I can, I'll trim it out and I'll jump back in.
Nice.
So, yeah. And then Monday, Courier has the All Stripes ride, holiday ride from Cadence, which we try and bring in all the clubs together and ride. There'll be a road and gravel ride from Cadence at 8:15 on Monday, the holiday. So we always do a holiday ride. They're quite successful. Nice. There'll probably be a couple hundred people doing either road or gravel.
Nice. That sounds good.
So question for you, is he known as Doug the Thug? Or is there any relationship there?
Well, it's just a punk fest,
Fair enough.
They just try and pound each other. I just dip in and watch and entertain myself. And, it's fun for me because, like, I look over and it's Thurlow, and you and I, we all grew up racing behind Thurlow, and he still has a hitch in his step. And, as we age, the hitch in your step just gets a little more hitchier.
If you don't work it out.
Yes.
So I it's fun to, to watch those guys pound each other, and it goes up some extra dumb steep hills and stuff, but I trim all that out.
Yeah.
Nice.
As Harry Callahan said, man's got to know his limitations.
That's right. Yeah. And I was wondering if the Thug Ride ever needed to do any type of like promotion and have a t-shirt or something. I think it was Tupac that had Thug Life tattooed like right on the front of him. So maybe you could mimic that, but have it be Thug Ride. You know, I don't know if it would actually be the right audience for that. But
I think they've beat you to it. They use a little hip hop to promote it. And I think is a fairly thuggy graphic that might even have been on Tupac's belly. I'm not quite sure, but.
All right, we may have to follow up on that.
All right.
What about you, KS?
Well, so I got, I've been kind of trying to focus a little bit more on consistency. And this week versus the duration of that ride I did the weekend prior that we talked about on episode 5. So I still teach one indoor class a week, and then I go take one as well in the 7 a.m. time slot, which gives me my little 55 minutes of intervals on a power based system. Then I got
hour
out
power.
Hour power. Then I got out for a couple of one shorter, you know, hour 15, and then one like 2.5 hour gravel ride this week, just to have a little consistency there. There's so much here in town. It was all by myself. Sometimes I like going out and just riding by myself. Get that kind of clarity of mind when I'm out there riding. So did those. What do I have planned for the weekend into next week? Well, there isn't going to be any riding in my forecast because at O'Dark 30 tomorrow morning. So we're recording this on Friday, the 29th of August. 5 a.m. flying out to Charlotte, North Carolina with my partner, Robin Farina, who manages the Sanisca women's cycling team and helping them out with a camp that they're going to do in Pulaski County, Virginia next week. So she has got all the riders coming in from France as well. Tomorrow we rendezvous in Charlotte. We're going to go up to Pulaski for 4 days and then up to the Maryland Cycling Classic. So I'm hoping to be able to, well, I'm going to gather a little content for the service course report from the camp. And then also, you know, up at the event, it's an interesting start list. You know, even Bobby Julich is the competition director for the men's race. You know, Bobby's been around the scene for a while. Anyone who's paid attention to road racing in the U.S. the last few decades knows of Bobby. Joanne Kisanowski, who was a top Kiwi rider. She is the women's competition director. Then we got some, an interesting mix of riders and teams there. So it should be fun.
Cool.
Yeah, we got some real interesting names. We got Oscar Sevilla. I don't know. He must be 50.
48, it said in the press release. 48 years old.
Yeah. Quinn Simmons, Brandon McNulty leading Team USA because I guess UAE won't be there. Team Skyline, which, you know, has connections here, and they do their winter camp here in Encinitas. So that's kind of a cool thing. So we got, you know, Nelson Paulus for EF. So there's some big names. And I think Velo News signed an exclusive to stream it on YouTube. So I think you'll be able to watch it live.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
I have to check that out.
Through the Outside Network. I think I just saw that in the news cycle today. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We got the big races up in Montreal, up in Quebec coming up the following weekend. So some of the teams have brought riders in that, you know, they can hook together some high level events in North America, which is pretty cool. Which reminds me, little sidebar, but a longtime friend of mine, a guy from Philadelphia by the name of Carlos Rogers, is bringing back the Philadelphia Cycling Classic. He did put in for a permit to have that be next year. It will be in August, and he's coordinating with these other two events so that there can actually be 3 weekends of racing. So I hope to see Carlos out there in Maryland as well. Maybe we can get an update from him on how the planning is going for that event, you know, which started out as the Core States Pro Championships, various sponsors, the same, you know, course they used in Philadelphia when it was the monument distance race, and we'll see what Carlos has up. I'm excited to hear about that.
Nice. Well, I think it's important for our viewers to know that that's the home of Tenacious K, right? KS, you are the 1990 U.S. Pro Champion by being tenacious and fighting back on Strawberry Hill, right? I mean, quickly tell the story.
So that event, I did ride it the year before. So I rode it the first time in 89. I was like, I'm taking out a pro license, because back then you just had to pay Jack Symes like $500 and you got a pro license and you could race the one pro race. So fast forward to 1990, I'm on a small team out of Southern California, sponsored by American Commerce National Bank. Four of us towed up, Darren, myself, Kenny Adams, and Peter Gilling from Denmark.
And Peter I just the Grueling.
Peter Gilling. Peter the Grueling.
Peter the Grueling.
That was his medieval name. Yes.
Danish Peter the Grueling.
Yes. Yeah.
He enjoyed losing his suitcase and eating Thai food on 11 and things like that.
Yeah.
And where I'll say one sidebar, I believe, of where Peter the Grueling came up is we would do the Solvang loop and you would ride up the coast from Santa Barbara and then come back down and stop through Solvang. And there's this one Solvang Danish bakery and it had this lineage written out on the side of the wall of all the years and all the kings of Denmark. And it was always, you know, somebody the great, somebody the this. And so that's how we dubbed Peter the Grueling.
Yeah.
I believe is how that came up.
That's exactly it. It was a play on his last name. So Peter Gilling. Yeah. So it was the four of us on the American Commerce team, you know, and we went in and we just all had a great day, you know. I mean, that was back when that event, I don't think it had ever not been hot there. I mean, it was a lot of years before that event. It wasn't hot. We prepared properly, which was like, you know, drinking a lot the couple of days before, you know, and having our, I think we were sponsored by Exceed Nutrition, if anybody remembers that. And they had this kind of loading stuff, I remember. And I just remember we were like sitting in our hotel rooms and we're like, well, you got to keep drinking this stuff. It's going to be really hot, you know. We had neutral feeders that helped us out. We had no team support back there. We had a neutral team car that helped us out. And it was just one of those days when everything came together. You know, and the big part of that event that got a lot of press was this climb, this steep climb about a kilometer long called the Manayunk Wall.
Yeah.
And the climb itself was steep, but it was really the approach to that climb that could make or break you. Because you came barreling down this or up and then down this, I think it was Manayunk Boulevard, or, you know, if not, I'm just saying it was the main street you took in. And then you hooked a right and immediately another right and then another left. You were under this train trestle you went under. So it was the light changed. It was like all of a sudden you went into a series of criterium corners back to back to back. You went through three corners
in those corners too,
with brick, underneath the railway. So brick in there, you know, train tracks, stuff drips off the train tracks and, you know, the bricks were kind of greasy. So you had to be careful. And then I figured out that my best way to go about doing well in this event was being as close to the front as I could possibly be every time going up that wall. And I will dig out my old training log, but I'm pretty sure I was the first guy through that first of three turns 8 out of 10 times. Nice. In the main field. And what that did is it allowed me to drift a little bit on the climb. I didn't have to sprint. I didn't have to really like try to close gaps. And I think between our pre-fueling and then my savvy positioning, basically knowing that course from riding it the year before, that made a huge difference. And, you know, that was when we finished on a bit of a shorter circuit. When you came back into town at the end, there were shorter circuits and the attacks started going, and I had good legs, you know. I mean, there was a big group that went into those finishing circuits, but if I remember correctly, there was a selection, and finally it was only 11 of us that battled it out. And of our little team that could, American Commerce Bank, you know, myself and Kenny Adams, half of our team was in that final selection, two of our four riders. And it came down to a sprint.
Yeah. Remind us who some of the other riders are that you were in the sprint with that day.
So
Jalabert.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A French guy named Laurent Jalabert, the guy that Canzoneri was the guy that won. Spago had two or three riders in there, James Urbanus, I think Oliver Starr, Gary Mulder.
Coors Light have a few people up there.
Alexi was in there for Coors Light, but yeah, you're pretty fortunate when you come to a flat long hard race sprinting against Alexi if it didn't have a hill. We had Kenny and myself, the guy that I wish wasn't in there, John Tomac, because I got myself boxed in with him, and I think I slammed against Tomac two or three times trying to get out of the way, and you can't move John Tomac because he's John Tomac. And
yeah,
you know, so as the sprint started, I was backing out around the backside of Tomac because, for me, you know, I was generally about as fast after 50 miles as I was after 150 miles. And I knew I had it. And I just, you know, I was in that position that I couldn't get out of. And as I backed out the sprint started, and, you know, Canzoneri, I think, pretty handily beat myself and Jalabert. And it was one of these things where, you know, the line, you know, it came 20 feet too soon. I had a head of steam, yeah, but you got to be there when you cross the line. So, you know, it's the one race where I'm like, the only race I've ever wished I could do over, because, you know, I knew I could have beat those guys, but I still got the pro title, and that's pretty cool. Yeah. So, yeah,
I'd say a head of steam, and also in those days, a huge head of hair, as I remember in
that sprint,
these were the no helmet days, and KS just had this massive head of brown curly hair that was wafting and bouncing in the air. Pretty sick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's important for our viewers. I mean, I know you guys out there all know this, but when you win the US Pro title, you wear the Stars and Stripes for one whole year. So right now, Quinn Simmons is wearing the Stars and Stripes. He wore it in the Tour de France. It's a big deal. You know, to be national champion, to be US Pro national champion was a big deal.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, hang on here. You know what?
It also meant that you know, rode the world championships that year because you were automatic qualifier for the US Pro Worlds team with Lamond. So, which we covered in episode one, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. That was quite a day.
You guys. Yeah.
You're pulling it up. Yeah. Well, I can remember one spicy. Oh, here we go. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that
head of hair.
That's the finish. So you're looking at it far left, Jalabert. Bike throw, and then that's me with the elbows out and the razor blades. Canzoneri's winning in the middle.
There's behind Kenny, him. Man.
Yeah, behind Canzoneri, the guy sitting up with the white helmet on, that's his teammate. And then as you're going across.
Yeah, that was the day. That was one of my most fun days. Oh, we lost you there, KS. That was one of my funnest days, being able to be a teammate and help my brother win the US Pro Championship. Rarely that gets to happen.
Yeah, I think we lost KS. He'll hopefully jump back on. I think we also saw John Tomac in that picture, and KS was on a Landshark with Summerlin Cycle stickers on the fork. He was riding time shoes and pedals, probably Shimano, but maybe not STI dual levers. Those might come in a week.
He got the STIs right after this race, so he was still running fingertip shifters. We were running back then for sprinting because you didn't have to take your hands off the drops at the very end. Yeah. Now, an interesting side biscuit to that. So I myself did that race. 156 miles was pretty long for me. And with, I'm trying to think, I feel like it was after the eighth ascension of the wall, we came back around. Yeah. And at that race, you would go through the top of the circle where the Statue of Rocky is. It's kind of big, round circle, roundabout, and then come back towards the finish. And I could remember I've been like dangling off the back several times and caught back on that lap and somehow made a move and actually got up to the front. And I'm going around the circle. I'm thinking, oh, I finally got some position. And all of a sudden I hear this distinctive whistle that I grew up hearing, which was a certain KS whistle that I can't even do. And he did that whistle. And I'm like, the only reason he would do that whistle is if there's something wrong. So I pulled out and dropped back, and he had a flat tire. And so he got his wheel change from the car, and we take off and we're going through the start finish. And then you came up through this little like dog leg and little riser. And that was where all the feed zones were. And a lot of people didn't know which side you were supposed to stop on or not, and doors. And so Kurt and I are coming back through the group of cars, and we're passing, and this one car pulled over and stopped to exchange some swan ears, weren't looking back at us, and threw up in a car door that we both missed, I mean, by probably a couple inches. which would have ended everything. And yet actually we blasted down the parkway and I just gave it everything to help KS get back in. And then that lap on the wall, I got shelled and I rode in my last two laps. And I remember coming across the finish and I went over to the pit. I see Kenny, but I don't see KS. And I go, oh, how'd it go? You know, and he's telling me, you know, how he went. He's like, I got 70. He goes, well, he's all, we got the jersey. And I'm like, jersey, what are you talking about? He's like, yeah, he's all, your brother's US pro champion. I was like, what? And so that was pretty exciting. Got to go over the podium, see him up there and everything. So I didn't even know. That was great. Brings up emotion in me right now. It was an awesome day.
Yeah, it was a big day. And there's like some great pictures of KS laying on a bed or somewhere with a wad of cash spread out across his belly or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. That was that night in the hotel.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish you sprung this one on me a little bit there, Ed. I would have, I found that finish photo there. But I do, I had a couple others. Well, I'll find those next time. I do have that. Yeah, there was a bet that between it was DS, myself, Greg McNeil, and maybe our coach, Doug Knox, is who was going to get the best result that year. And I think we each threw $100 in the pot. And midway through the season, everybody coughed up. So, yeah.
KS.
Yeah.
That was a great picture.
No, I had some problem. I was using this, the app for this service we're using. I'm back to the website. But yeah, so. Kenny, yeah, James Urbanus. I think that's Dan Fox on the very far right. Dan Fox, a Philadelphia local. So he was in there. So Tomac, if you go back, Tomac is the guy over my right shoulder. And then next to Tomac behind the elbow of Canzoneri's teammate, that's Harry Gary Mulder, as you can see by the flowing locks. Yeah, that was quite a day.
Well, it'll be great to see that race come back. It deserves to be back. And, you know, Philadelphia has a long history and that race was a big deal in this country. So it'll be fantastic. And, you know, it had history with Eric Heiden and Lance Armstrong and a lot of big names. So,
right. Schuler.
So we wanted to tease something we got coming up. Cass, you want to tease a little bit about the Bovine Classic?
Yeah, so we mentioned a little bit last week, but our first live broadcast for the service course report is going to happen at the Bovine Classic. So we'll be in Atascadero. I think it's that third weekend of October, and we'll broadcast live. The plan is to broadcast live from the venue for sure on event day, and potentially the evening before at packet pickup. We'll have some fun stuff going on there. The three of us are going to be in Atascadero. And so our plan is to do, there's two shakeout rides, one Thursday afternoon up in Paso. And then another one Friday morning that leaves from the start finish area at the Sunken Gardens in Atascadero. So exciting stuff. Wow.
Yeah, so we're October hoping, 25th.
Yep, that's
25th.
It.
Yeah. So that's going to be fun to do, you know, the technology is allowing the three of us to do that. And it's going to be some of the same technology. You might notice that Darren is broadcasting from a different location than we've seen before, testing out the Starlink. It appears
Starlink
to be working.
Mini.
Yeah. Starlink Mini.
So, maiden voyage. So we're going to be using that when we're up at the events this year, starting with the Bovine, and then we'll keep you clued in, have a few more on tap.
Awesome.
We won't step out in front of anyone with our Starlink backpack, but
no, that's for sure. All right.
So the La Vuelta started. It's a little bit of a slow boil, but there's been some percolations. What's caught your guys' eyes?
Well, I would say for me the biggest one is that stage. I believe it was 3 that Gadu won. If that's how you pronounce his name. Yeah, where they were coming up to the line and Mads lead out, Peterson's lead out, maybe dropped him off a little bit earlier. And it was kind of one of those long uphill sprints. And there was a right-hand turn. And if you watch Gaudu in that, it was pretty amazing. He had great legs because he was like 5 guys back and somebody left a gap and he darted around one and another and they're coming into this right turn. And Mads was kind of like doing the long, slow, big dude, big gear lead out. It seemed like to kind of wind it up and kind of took a line through the corner. And Jonas set up a little bit wider, and Gadu just goes right up the inside. And unfortunately, it was a little blocked by the building, and the video was amazing. Went into the corner third, came out first, passed both Jonas and Mods, and had the momentum and sprinted it right to the line. And those guys couldn't beat him. And I thought it was kind of funny afterwards. In the warm down, Jonas is on his, you know, TT bike, and they're warming down, and they asked him about it, and he didn't seem too pleased with Gadu and called it getting dive bombed or something like that, which to me just looks like a savvy move of somebody in a sprint going up the inside. So maybe that's part of, as Jonas seems to be participating more in the sprint finishes now, following the Tade move, maybe he needs to figure out that that's not really a dive bomb, or if it is, it's a positive move. You can't be salty at that move. That was a great move. Any sprinter finisher that watched that was like, oh yeah, that's what I was thinking. So that was the one that I liked. The biggest one that I've seen so far was pretty cool.
Yeah, I would definitely agree on that.
Go ahead, Cass.
Sorry. I was gonna say, I would agree on that one. That was like, you saw that coming, and it was like they handed it to him on a plate. I mean, yeah, he had to be willing to go do it, but it was like, you know, he beat Mads Pedersen in a sprint,
right?
Little David Godu beat Mads Pedersen in a sprint. And it wasn't because he was faster. It was because he was more savvy and took the right line and carried his momentum better.
Yeah. Well, and also it wasn't even, sorry about that, guys. It wasn't even as if his move on the inside, he cut him off or did anything like that. He didn't impede their progress. That's why I couldn't see why Jonas is so mad about that. He just went up the inside. Those guys swung wide.
Yeah.
Well, and part of Jonas's sprinting technique is he's a little bit all over the place. You know, he's swinging this way and that way. I know, because he's not a sprinter. So I know why he's doing what he's doing. I can feel it in his bones. I understand he's trying to puppy dog every direction he can, but he just puppy dogged to the left, and he left the doggy door open.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that was really cool. And then the fact that he took the jersey the one day they finished in France.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool.
And yeah, was really cool.
Yeah. And then they were talking about on the broadcast that he had actually been left off the tour roster, which I didn't realize. So maybe that was a little fire that, you know, after all the expectations of that guy after winning the Tour de l'Avenir, you know, we read about how brutal the French press is, not the coffee, but, you know, the press in France.
French press. Nice one, Cass.
Yeah.
The French press.
Must be those espresso beans I've been eating. You know, they put a lot of pressure on him, and it was just very cool to see that, and to see the joy on his face.
Right. Yeah. So that was cool. Really great.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I would say, as I'm talking, I'll keep going here, because, you know, if you've watched today, well, today I said is Friday. Spoiler alert if you haven't, but there was a hat trick for UAE the last three stages with the team time trial, then with Jay Vine, then with Juan Ayuso. If there's any doubt about that team when Tade's not there, I mean, look at that. They won three stages in a row at the Vuelta, and we're not even through the first week. So that was pretty phenomenal. And then the little sidebar for me is that, you know, we talk about bike handling and experience and that. Jay Vine came through the Zwift Academy, right? He was an indoor racer, and now he's winning at the highest level in the world. And so, you know, there is hope, you know, for you Zwifties out there. Just get outside and ride your bike as well. Yeah. And it can come together. So that was pretty wild.
That is really cool. Yeah. If you got the motor, man, get your skills there and you're in.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, he looks like he's a pretty skilled rider. I remember feeling like he was crashing a bit in the beginning there, but he looks pretty good on a bike.
He looks good on a bike. He definitely does. Pedals well, handles well, looks loose on there. That's what you need for some good handling.
Well, if you watch that, his solo there on the end of the stage yesterday, the guy looked like a freaking freight train. I'm going to say going down the road, but he was going up the road. But it was super impressive. And then you flip forward to stage six today, and he was a freight train for Ayuso. They were both in the breakaway. And so, you know, he got his stage win, but he's a selfless teammate. So hats off to you, Jay Vine. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. Anything else from the Vuelta you guys are liking?
Well, I did. I want to share something. I'll jump back
let's
in.
See it.
But what I thought was really cool was this Where's my, see, now I'm in the, it's a little bit different. This right here, how Lotto has gone back to their roots with this jersey that they're wearing in the Vuelta. So if you've watched the Giro, right, or the Tour de France, in the Giro, EF, they have a pink jersey. They have to change it for the Giro because it looks too similar to the leader's jersey. Visma has a yellow jersey that they race all year that they change for the Tour because the leader's jersey is yellow. Well, Lotto has a red jersey, and they kind of harken back to their past with this design. And I just like it. You can see this jersey from a mile away. I mean, it's definitely busy, right? But I was like, why does that thing look so familiar? And I was like, huh. So I was like, that's what the jersey used to look like. So, you know, one of the benefits of the internet is you can find this information. It's a 40-year anniversary of their first jersey. So I went and I found this one. So that's, you know, oh, that didn't, it switched here. It didn't switch for me. So I need to share a different one here. So I thought it was going to allow me to swipe between. So this is a like the original Lotto jersey. So
It is actually
looks
very
similar.
similar.
Lotto Super Club. It's got the different colors. You know, it doesn't have the opposite sleeves. MBK up there on the chest. Moto Bacan, Mavic. You know, and then the Super Club. I don't know what that was. Maybe our readers can let me know on that. But then I found this one, which I thought was, you know, even makes it better. So where are we? Let me, this guy right here.
Let's check it.
Johann
But yeah,
Museo. There we go. Yeah.
hair club for men.
The many faces of Museo, but there's a couple versions of that jersey. And what's kind of wild too is you look at that and it's like, look at how baggy the jerseys were on these guys back then. I mean, even well into the 2000s, but there's another couple of versions of it as well. So pretty cool just to look at a little bit of history there. It was kind of similar to what we saw. Perhaps some of you guys remember what we saw with Uno X at the Liège-Bastogne-Liège Classic this year, where they paid an homage to the original 7-Eleven jersey because
The Hundved
Uno
years.
X owns 7-Elevens in Norway, so they did that. But I like how the teams are having fun with this and that the UCI isn't like being the UCI and they're actually letting it happen. So that's pretty cool. So that was just something that came to mind and I was like, wow, that's some cool stuff there. So
Yeah, that's
yeah.
cool. That's good for bringing it up.
So
So
another segment or a topic has been, you know, we covered the transfer news. The biggest news or drama in the news was the Derek G kind of pulling sort of the NFL wide receiver type technique of I'm not going to play anymore for my contract. I'm not playing this year. I'm going to sit out a year. Derek G's contract dispute. What do you guys think about that?
it's kind of interesting. I mean, he hasn't really said, it said he terminated the contract, which was supposed to run through 2028, but didn't really give any details. But I think that he's learned, if we've learned from past disputes, like when Wout left his team, Van Aert, to go to whatever it would have been back then, I guess Visma, still the earlier iteration of it. You learn that if you say stuff up front early on, it can bite you later when you're going to court with different teams, and the UCI and lawyers. And so seems like he's just been pretty quiet, hasn't said anything other than just it's an untenable situation that he can't stay in and he's broken the contract. So we haven't really heard anything more than that, but it does bring up an interesting point just about contracts. And you can have a contract, but there's always outs. You know, whether there are or aren't outs, I think everybody believes they've gotten out. So this one's obviously going to be settled up in court.
Yeah. I mean,
I think it involved Swiss employment law. I think it's a Swiss contract, if I so it'll be
Interesting.
Swiss employment law. The other thing is just a reminder, I do believe he was supposed to ride the Vuelta, so he is not there.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Well, that's too bad.
Interesting.
Anytime a bike racer is just not racing when they're fit and in the prime of their career, you hope they're out there. But obviously, we got to respect him and respect that he's got something going on that makes him feel like he can't be at that team anymore. So it'll be interesting to see where he pops up. There were some rumors of Ineos, but of course they can't bring anything up right now because you're still trying to sort out your old deal, getting out of that contract.
That's really interesting. When we're talking about transfers, I had an interesting experience last December. I went to a Tudor watch VIP ride up in Laguna Beach. And so Tudor Pro Cycling was, you know, rolling out their thing. And it was maybe watch consumers and watch dealers who were on the ride, and BMC bikes, fully supported, lunch, the whole deal, you know, support vehicles, everything. And Alaphilippe was there, but we were strictly told no photos. It's not January 1st. So we weren't allowed to photograph him. He wasn't allowed to ride. He wasn't allowed to be seen near a BMC bike, you know, but he was there. it was kind of an interesting reminder of that the transfers take place January 1st. So,
right. Transfer January 1st. Now it's interesting in the sport of professional motocross and supercross, at least in America, based on the way the season goes, most of their contracts are 12 months, but they run October 1 to September 30th. As the end of September, usually all the racing is done. And then those guys have to do, unlike the sport of professional road cycling, like obviously you would want to be on your new equipment. And I'm sure, you know, there's different ways that they work around that, you know, as far as wanting to ride their new stuff, but you can still go out and train and get fit on your old bike. With motocross, there's so much testing that goes on in terms of the handling of the bike and suspension components and linkage and all of that, that they really need several months of testing and riding on the new bike to show up. You know, the first race of the year is usually the first or second weekend of January. So that's always in October to, you know, October 1 to September 30th. With a few modifications, like the quote unquote, like world championships of motocross is an event called the Motocross de Nations. And that usually happens in October. So this year, both Eli Tomac and Chase Sexton are on the Motocross of de Nations team, but it's in October. So they got contract extensions to allow them to race the bike that they've been racing all this year, just at the de Nations. Then they switch right after. So then again, the contract says one thing, but if all parties are involved and you can massage it a little bit, then, you know, then you can get it done.
Well, speaking of big contracts, we had sort of the sad demise of Chris Froome. Mm-hmm.
You can tell us what happened to him, Ed.
Well, my understanding was a training crash and he was airlifted from it, which means, you know, even though they said the injuries were not super serious, I mean, anytime you're airlifted from an accident site, that means you weren't in great shape. And I think he broke vertebrae in his back. You know, this probably sadly wraps up the end of his career, I would think. You know, crashes have followed this guy.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what we were talking about, is interesting that a high-speed crash took him out of his tour career, basically, before that 19 tour, of which he's never really regained anything close to that form. And this is the last year of his Israel Premier Tech contract, and hadn't had a contract. So unfortunately for him, you know, even if his career would end right now, it's a bummer to end a career in a hospital bed and healing up, rather than just getting to ride out the last few gravy races at the end of the year, some Japanese criteriums and stuff, for him to go off into the distance. But that's the cruel part of sport. You could be a four-time tour winner, but nobody gets to write their exit plan. You know, sport has a way of just writing it for you.
Sorry. Got a little camera mojo going on here.
No problem.
You know, maybe we'll still see Froome at some end of season Japanese criteriums. You never know.
He'll make it back.
Yeah. And I'm sure Anthony Shriver will bring him back to the best buddies, private ride down there in Southern Florida in like November, you know? So you know, I mean, the guy's won all three grand tours, you know, and was definitely an entertaining individual to watch. So yeah, all the best to him and his recovery. Yeah. Still got the rest of his life to be concerned about.
That's right.
Yeah.
We may see him ride Unbound or Leadville or something. You never know.
That would be interesting.
We did see Roman Bardet doing some gravel racing. He actually won a gravel race, but we can save that for later. But that, you know, if we're into transfer news, we talked about racing. You know, you guys brought up, DS, you were bringing up an interesting point about equipment, especially with the motocross guys, and how, you know, there's so much more that goes on with all the tuning with the suspension and the motors, and how different. I mean, right, bike racing, you ride Shimano or you ride SRAM or you ride Campy. right? And you ride a carbon bike, I mean, there's some adjustments. But I read a piece a couple weeks ago, that even though Remco is going from one specialized sponsored team to another, they don't share, like, all that Quickstep data of all his time trial stuff will not get shared with Bora Hansgrohe. So even though he's going to be on the same bike and the same helmet and the same shoes, he's got to go back in, you know, probably come back over to Morgan Hill, get into right. the wind tunnel and do that testing. So that was, I was very surprised about that, but it talks about the integrity of what Specialized is doing there and how they keep that information siloed between teams, even, you know, when there's a racer involved. I mean, and who knows if it's like, okay, we come to agreement and we can transfer some of that data, but right. that was, seeing that, I was like, huh.
You know, that is interesting.
Yeah. And Ed, I mean,
come over with that.
Yeah. And you brought that up. Like, the dude's super technically savvy, like everything down to the, you know, the fraction of a millimeter and a degree and this stuff there, like, right. So he's got to have that stuff dialed. So, you know, I don't know if Remco's racing the world, but I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't in Northern California already. You never know.
Getting a jump on it.
Yeah.
But I also think that Specialized is going to lean in even more to Remco. You know, we had the Remco shoe this summer, but I feel like, you know, Specialized leaned into Sagan. You know, yeah. they had like Sagan shoes and maybe a helmet or a few items. I feel like, you know, that this is working for Specialized and that they are going to lean in even more to Remco. And I bet you that's part of the whole package.
Yeah, part of the whole package. That's definitely, well, I mean, interestingly enough, the team that he's going to, Bora, some people remember, some people won't, wasn't even a team. That team was built around Sagan. But he was the Tade. He rescued cycling really after the doping years, you know, and came back out of it. And so it's pretty cool to think that that entire team, I mean, that's when you got some star power. It's one thing going to a team. It's another thing when they say, you're so great and we need to promote cycling in this region. We're just building a team around you. So it is kind of cool that that team that still exists off the back of Sagan is now taking Specialized next, you know, number one star and slotting him right in.
Yeah.
Yeah,
cool
yeah.
stuff. Well, I mean, Remco, a lot of technology, he's into that. We got some new stuff as far as technology goes, not some big things, but there was some stuff in the news. Most notably, I saw with Shimano doing some stuff with cleats. And since I don't ride Shimano pedals, what do you got on that? You know, they got a couple of things, right? A multi-angle entry cleat, and then for lack of a better term, like a floating pontoon type cleat, right?
Yeah. What do you think, Ed?
So I thought about this a little bit. One thing with Shimano is sometimes they bring us things we don't know we need. Like, I didn't know in 1985 that I needed SIS shifting, which is index shifting. For those of you that don't know, like, it would click into each gear. We used friction shifting and this was a big change. And I remember, wow, I go, this is amazing. I didn't know I needed this.
Right.
So when I think about SPD cleats, sometimes I think about the slop. I go, there's a little click, there's a little slop, but man, those things are just bomb proof. And whenever I leave them and I go to Crank Brothers and I come back to SPD, I go, I should have never left. So I'm a huge fan. There is a little click and a little slop, but maybe my knees enjoy that click and slop, you know?
Yeah.
You take it away, my knees might not be quite so happy. So do I need to be able to enter my cleat at all these different ways in a different angle? Sounds great. Do I need it? We'll see. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. I can say that the modification that they made to the cleat for people who will look at it, they just kind of ground down the front of the nose. And normally on a Shimano cleat, as Shimano explained, you can only go toe in, get the front of that SPD cleat in, and then push the back in. Now this makes it so that you can just push straight in or even get the back in first and snap the front, which if you're, you know, going out on a long distance gravel ride, you're probably not clipping in and out of there 20 times. But I can say, you know, for riding a mountain bike, and especially like my enduro bike, there's definitely times where you go through a section and clip out and you're trying to get your foot in and get it in there. And sometimes you might get the back in and then the front won't go in. So you have to lift up and put it in. So they claim that it doesn't change the retention. You know, you still have the same retention as before, but that it just makes it a little bit easier to get in. So it'll be interesting to see. I've been on those SHM51s, I think is the existing 30-year-old model of cleat for a long time. So I'll be kind of interested to try those out and see.
Kind of seems like it's an enduro cleat, to be honest, but
yeah, I would say probably more, but I mean, if it's easier to get in and it doesn't hurt anything else, that's probably good for everybody.
Yeah.
But definitely would lean more towards a discipline where you're putting your feet in and out and also trying to get them in and fast and might not have everything aligned. I think it helps just guide you in.
For cyclocross, it's for sure, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For cross.
So tell me this, how is Shimano recently in foul weather? I mean, both you guys are in sunny Central and Southern California, so you don't get a ton of rain, a ton of mud. But that was always, you know, when the attack pedal came out, you know, that mud clearance was huge. In that the pedal would clear the mud out, so when you stepped in, it actually pushed, you know, mud or sand or whatever away. I haven't heard so much about that lately, but how is Shimano in the foul weather and on the off-road pedals?
My experience is if I'm having trouble with Shimano, I'm having trouble somewhere else on my bike. Like I'm clogged somewhere else already. Like if my cleats are clogged, my rear
tires,
yeah,
like something else is going on.
I'm already paint sticking my rear triangle before I'm cleaning my shoes. So I'm not a great mud tester exemplar.
Yeah, I've had pretty decent luck with them. I definitely say, like, if it's a really sticky mud and you try and come right down on it, there's times when, you know, you can feel like it gets caked in and you're trying to push and it won't go in. You know, I'm 195 pounds, so I've got a decent amount of force. So I've found that I can usually, even if I feel a little bit of that mud, if I just wiggle it a little bit, I'll usually find the front part of the cleat is in. And if I snap in, if it doesn't go right in, a little wiggle will usually get me in. Now, again, Southern California, we have a lot of, you know, sandstone and sand in our soil out here. So it's not like super sloppy East Coast mud. But definitely, as you remember, that one gravel ride we did, KS, we dropped down this one section after a heavy rain and we ended up walking out. Our tires went from, I think, 45s to like 2.5s in about 20 feet. And we had to walk it out. So, yeah, I think part of it too, I mean, obviously, like Crank Brothers are timed, that two bar with the spring system, I think is probably always going to have an edge up on, you know, on mud clearance. I think as far as the Shimano's go, also the shoe you're wearing, I run a Shimano shoe and, you know, with the cleat and the shoe together and a good channel on the shoe, I think that helps out a bit with Shimano clearing. And also depending on how far out or in you run your shoe, you know, which is where the cleat is in between the fixed pontoons on the bottom of the cleat. If you're all the way over onto one side or the other, as opposed to the cleat being right in the middle, because I tend to run my feet a little bit that way. It can maybe clog a little bit more, but I haven't had it be like some huge issue where I'm just out there scratching my head like I can't clip into my pedals.
Nice. So it's not the issue it was back,
right,
back in the early days of the attack pedal. Well,
no.
Cool.
Now, interestingly enough, the other tech news with Shimano, aside from just this new cleat, is they actually came out with a whole kind of like cleat mounting system. This new model that's like a kind of a pontoon. And the main part of that is, which I was just discussing, on a normal shoe where kind of like those side parts of the shoe, would it be, if you want to call it the fixed pontoon, it's probably not
the
pontoon,
lugs.
The lugs, yes, thank you. You know, depending on where your cleat moves left and right and front and back, you're changing where those lugs contact the pedal. This new pontoon design is made so that wherever you move the cleat, the pontoon is attached to the cleat. So those lugs actually move with the cleat. So whether your cleat's forward or back or a little more left or right on the shoe, it always maintains that perfect spacing between the side of the cleat and the lugs. And they say you're getting, you know, like road quality connection, but still on an SPD platform. So I think that's the one that I'm really interested in. The cleat is obviously nice because you can put it on any shoe you have. The pontoons, you have to invest in the new, it's a new platform. You know, the sole's a little bit different, but I think that'll be interesting as well.
So what's the bolt pattern on that pontoon cleat? Is it SPD? Is it two bolt?
Yeah, it's still SPD.
Still, okay.
Yep, still the same bolt pattern. You bolt the cleat right on. I mean, Shimano actually had a road pedal, an SPD road pedal they tried to make. I mean, I don't even know when that would have been, sometime in the 90s, I think. And you actually used an, you could put it on, they made SPD bolt road shoes. So you could put it on road shoe and it was still a tube bolt, but this little pontoon bolted underneath the cleat and that had your little feet on there. So you could actually run them on any shoe. But I mean that was, 30-year-old technology. This new one looks a heck of a lot better. So I'll be interested to try that out.
I'll have to look into that because that's when I first saw that thing. I'm like, it just looks like the old pontoon, which there may be a set of those down in my parts drawers. So,
I think I might have one as well.
yeah, imagine that.
Yeah, so well, that'll be interesting. We'll have to update once we get a little bit more news on those or get a chance to ride them. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? Talk. We
Sorry about
got
that, guys.
old. Oh, old. Old is new. We move into our amateur segment.
Amateur.
Tour, which is he has brought this first one up as it was pretty awesome, and it goes back to old because it was well, it was a dude we used to hang out with and race with, and now his son's racing in the
His
World
son,
Tour. Yeah.
yeah, Clark Sheehan, who I think first raced against him at the Mini Red Zinger Junior Classic in 1983 in Colorado, and Clark went on to have a great cycling career. Now his son Riley, who's racing, amazing pro, like incredible, but had an amateur move in stage two of the Deutschland Tour where he did the old "put your arms up early to celebrate." And you don't realize that somebody else is coming around the outside and pips you. So, in spite of the amazing cyclist he is in professional, our amateur award is going to go to Riley Amateur. You got to know you have the win before you throw those arms up.
Well, and that brings us, so now my swiping is working. So then we got thinking, right? So Riley did that. He's not in bad company. Poor company. Bad company, that's a band. So the king of Milan San Remo, Eric Zabel, seen here in 2000, what was it? 2004. He had already won three or four of these. He's won four total. But you look at this, so massive sprint coming to the line. Zabel in the German champion jersey posted up a little early, and you look to the left under his right arm, and you see the orange and blue of Rabobank, Oscar Fieri,
Oscar Fieri, yep.
winning in a bike throw. Zabel ended up second, and then Gavin O'Grady, who's also throwing next to Fieri, he was
Stuart
third.
O'Grady.
Or I'm sorry, yeah, Stuart O'Grady.
Gavin, we raced against.
Gavin, yeah, that was a few years earlier. Yeah, how you doing, Gavin? Yeah. But anyway, yeah, we're looking at that and we're like, well, this is not something that hasn't happened before.
Right.
But I mean, even the best at that point, Zabel was like at the very top of the game and was an amateur. So then it was like
Mature.
amateur. So then we've seen some of this before, right? So then we're
Right.
like, I saw, and then I was starting to think about it, and I remember this one. So this is the 2021 Brabantse-Pil, which is a one of those transition races, kind of a semi-classic between the Northern Classics and the Ardennes Classics. And the bike throw in the Stars and Stripes on the left-hand side is Ruth Winder, and she's beating a rider who I had never really heard of before, but now we all know Demi Vollering. And Vollering, she did. She posted up early, and Winder timed her bike throw perfectly. And if our tech works here, this is the finish photo of that. So you can see how close it was, like what a centimeter or something
Yeah.
ridiculous. And we can zoom in. I think it was 2 centimeters, four
Yeah, look at the bike
four
throw.
thousandths of a second. But yeah, if you look at her, you look at Winder's bike throw, and now it's Ruth Edwards. She's married. She had retired, and now she came back. Actually, going to be racing the world this year. But check out. You can see. I can see. I have zoom in. Look where her saddle is. Right, like
Oh, yeah,
she's got
that's
the
a great
saddle.
bike
That's
throw.
a that is an amazing bike throw. That's her saddle there, like on the belly. Like that was the
Yep.
bike throw that won that. So you never say die. Right? Like
That's
you
right.
can't ever say die. So then it was like, well, God, we've even got more of that, right? Like, so then we're like, We've seen this from when we were kids, right?
Yeah.
So we grew up racing on the Santa Barbara Bike Club, which was, you know, back in the day, it was clubs you raced for. You know, there were race teams, but you also had to be affiliated with a club. A guy on the Santa Barbara Bike Club who was an amazing racer, now has moved into a career as a photographer, nature photographer, Chris Jordan. But this picture, so if you look, this is the Cycling USA publication. And what a great headliner there. Whoops. So Jordan with his, Chris Jordan. With his hands on his head. And this, Chris Jordan, this is the March 1983 cover of Cycling USA magazine. This was a collegiate criterium. There used to be a lot of collegiate races at the same time as the USCF races back then. And Chris had actually won the Willows Road Race the day before, which was one of the premier road races in Southern California. Yeah. And I think he was, you know, he was racing for UC Santa Barbara, and this guy, Sean Storm, who's, you know, rubbing it in maybe just a little bit there. Yeah. Chris posted up. He was going to do two in a row. And that one showed up. And I just remember, you know, this was something that we all got in the mail because we had a license with the USCF back then. And that one was there. And it was just like, oh man, it still happens. It happens today. It happened, you know, this week in the World Tour or in the last weekend. Right. So yeah, it was,
That's funny. Definitely, I mean, not a way to lose a race. Might be an okay way to win a race, which actually got me thinking between the three of us, have any of you ever won or lost a race in this fashion? Have you ever thrown it up too soon to celebrate and somebody beat you, or the other way, took advantage? So I'm kind of curious if you guys have.
Well, you know, it's funny, I actually have, and you reminded me of this. You know, we were talking a little earlier in the episode about going to the Bovine Classic in Atascadero. Well, there used to be an Atascadero criterium. And Diaz reminded me that when I won the Atascadero criterium in 1988, actually beat my teammate who, I don't know, he jumped me on the backside. I can't remember if we were doing a lead out or what. Got a huge gap, and like the last half a lap, I feel like I sprinted out of the saddle around the whole last half a lap through the corners. And that course might have even had like six turns in it, if I remember.
It was a six turn course.
It was a six turn. So it wasn't just a square. It had at least one left in there. But I think it was like right around City Hall where we'll be at the Bovine. And Jack Vanderveen and I sprinted all the way to the line, and DS reminded me that Jack, he posted up and I got him at the finish. Yeah. So a happier one rather than the other way around. So I guess I got to deliver that one time. And you had one too, didn't you, DS?
Yeah. I was thinking back. I almost was on the losing end of it. Now this is going way back when I was a junior racer. And we had a race over in San Ynez, a road race over there. And I ended up off in a two-man winning break with a friend of ours, Phil Johansson, who was part of our racing group at that time. And I remember that my dad came up to watch the race and he had bought a new camera. And I was like, oh yeah, I got to, you know, if I can win this race, I'm going to get a cool victory photo. My dad's going to have some snaps of this. And so came to the line with Phil, and there was like a rolling hill, I don't know, 100 yards out. And I jumped Phil really hard. He was waiting for the sprint and I got a gap and I look back and I'm just like, woo, I'm sitting up. Yeah. I got my arms up and everything rolling to the line, thinking about the finish line photo that my dad's going to get, not realizing that it was a little bit further from where I attacked Phil and he did not give up and he was chasing. I had no idea. I'm just, woo, people are screaming and I crossed the line and he blew by. I mean, talk about you need another 20 yards KS or whatever. Phil probably needed about 15 feet and he would have beat me. But luckily, I held on for the win and my dad did get a good photo. I'll have to see if I can fish that up and find that one. So I almost lost it. Lost it in that manner, but luckily just came through with the good. So that was my one. What about you, Ed?
I'm clean on this one.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't involved in too many sprints.
Good point.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah.
If I ever did well in a sprint, I attacked from 1K out. So,
right.
I probably did that to other people.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, and
well,
then
that's good.
Yeah. Oh, and then it's, you know, it's funny. So we were talking about this, right? And we've got some different text threads with old buddies like we raced with when we were juniors doing that. One of the guys who really has, I mean, the main guy who's really tied us all back together and kind of got us all back together, you know, whether it's on a text or a phone call, is a guy named David Wong.
Yeah.
Dave, we were, I think he was a year younger than me, but we were the same, well, a year younger in cycling years, but we raced, or we went to school. We were in the same grade at Santa Barbara High. Met Dave. Well, we went to Santa Barbara High School, but he also, you know, was coming up racing at the same time as us. And I remember there was, back when we were juniors, and we had talked about this before, like there were so many races. Like there was a race every weekend down Southern California, whether it was, you know, in the greater, you know, in the San Fernando Valley or the greater LA area or down, you know, Orange County or San Diego. And this race, the Scott Park Criterium. And we were, I think I was, I remember if I was a junior, I was maybe racing the senior race, but Dave Wong, and let me pull up a picture of Dave because we found a great one of him as well. But Dave, Scott Park Criterium, Dave was a sprinter. So like, Ed, if you were like, you didn't contest many sprints at all, Dave mostly contested sprints. The dude had a turn of speed, man. He was super fast. And Dave found himself off the front, soloing off the front of this Criterium. And he had the lead. He's going, people are going nuts. And Dave comes around for the bell lap and throws his arms up. He thought he had won the race and the bell had won the go. There's Dave right there. So this is Dave maybe a year or two later, on the Choach team, which Doug Knox started, which would kept the juniors going, the Choach bike. But so Dave threw his arms up and then they rang the bell and it was like, you know, he had given everything. The race came around. Dave didn't win. There was a sprint. Let's see if I can zoom that at all. But then so we were kind of curious about this. So I got us on a text thread with Dave earlier this week.
Yeah.
And he confirmed that's exactly what happened. But then what I didn't realize is he went back there the next year and won that race. So talking about exercising your demons, man, it was like, that was such a great story. And then he said that Phil Johansson, who almost took you at that San Ynez road race, was there with him to celebrate. So, so very cool. But, you know, one of the funniest things that we remember, and DSU brought this up, is that Doug Knox, who we spoke about before, who got this Choach team going and really, really helped a lot of us, all of us that came through that Santa Barbara junior scene, getting better. I think, you know, after he gave Dave a load of crap for, you know, not timing that perfectly, he walked up to him and as Dave reminded us, he said, "Dave, what went wrong?" And so from there, and DS, you can take it from there. It was like that it took on a life of its own.
That saying just took on a life of its own amongst the group of us juniors. And it just became a tagline for if something got messed up, didn't go according to plan, we would look at one or the other and be like, "Dude, what went wrong?" It just kind of became our tagline to use, not just for, you know, for a race move, but for anything that didn't go the right way. It just kind of became a joke amongst all of us. And we did confirm with Dave yesterday, the day before, getting all the correct facts about this. And so we all had a good laugh about that. But that was our tagline, what went wrong, which we thought would be a great way to kind of lead in a new segment here that we'll talk about, is when things don't go according to plan, you got to ask yourself, what went wrong?
So that was pretty hilarious. So as an homage to Dave, I would say from the last episode, my what went wrong, which is, you know, not quite amateur, is we were talking about Q36.5 getting their first world tour win. And I incorrectly said that it was Corbin Strong that won for them. For those of you that know, Corbin Strong does not race for Q36.5, races for Israel Premier Tech, and it was actually Rory Townsend that won the Cy Classics in Hamburg. So our What Went Wrong, What Went Wrong segment, new, starting here in episode 6 is that. So, and you know, if you've ever watched Seth Meyers on the late night, they do corrections once a week. We'll do What Went Wrong when we correct things at the Service Course Report podcast. So
thanks, maybe Dave. Yeah, thanks, Dave. Yeah, and maybe just some things that don't go right in general will bring up our What Went Wrong. So
true.
One piece of feedback that we got from some of our viewers and listeners is that they love it when we break down a bike. So looking at Dave's bike here, he has a King headset, Chinelli bars. He may have early Shimano Durace. Doug set us up with early Shimano Durace, which was a huge culture shock for us. All of a sudden, we went from growing up on Campy to riding Shimano.
Look like Campy, though, because the rear derailleur looks like the whatever you called it before they did the flat parallelogram when it's still angled down. So that would look like it would be a Nova Record. Clips and scraps, clips and straps, Marisi shoes, maybe?
Yeah, probably Simplex friction shifters.
Yeah, we ran those.
But look at that front hub. The front hub looks more Shimano-esque than Campy. Remember that that Dura-Ace EX hub? It had like a little raised section in the middle with like a little gold kind of ring on it.
Campy had the little like metal clip that went on there in the little hole. Remember that?
The little
like on the side of the hub.
Early Aero rims, by the way. Yeah. You know,
That was as Aero as the rims got back then.
Yeah.
Compared to today, look at that.
Yeah. And some of these parts had legacy with Santa Barbara Bike Club because Santa Barbara Bike Club was early to ride Shimano and then later Sun Tour. And, you know, here is an original Chris King headset. And this headset probably came during a period of time when Chris wasn't making headsets and you had to kind of scrap together and find one. You know, and those headsets were originally made probably in the Hendrickson's basement in Santa Barbara.
Probably put together. I would say the one amazing thing that none of us have looked at as we're all looking at the bikes is that headgear. Yeah. The good old hairnet.
That helmet. Yeah.
That definitely dates. Now, this would have been, I believe Choach was 85. I know that was when I got on my Choach the year before we were on Fagin. So we were on the Choach. And so that was 85. And the next year in 1986 was when USA Cycling, in order to keep their insurance and keep racing, switched to the hard shell rule. So this would have been the last year as amateurs that we raced in hairnets, starting in 86. Sure. That Vel V1 Pro, I remember my neck was sore for the first like month going out on training rides with that thing. It felt so heavy.
I can remember braking bumps, San Luis Obispo Criterium. You'd come down into that downhill turn, braking bumps, and your V1 Pro would be bouncing so hard off your glasses. Gung, 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 gung. I don't know which was worse, the helmet bouncing off your glasses or whatever. I mean, that helmet would bounce.
Definitely. That's a great shot. And also the cool thing with the hairnet is if you have kind of like the short spiky hair, then your hair would pop up out of the helmet, which in this day and age in the hard shell, there's a few people that seem to pull it off. Yes. I think Tade does that pretty good. It pokes up out of his helmet, but some great details from this great era. Yeah, that looks great.
Well, I think that about wraps up episode 6.
Yeah.
We look forward to Kurt Stockton's report from the Maryland Cycling Classic. We'll be sharing some clips on Instagram and YouTube Shorts. And pencil out October 25th at the Bovine Classic. Come ride with us. You know, do the shakeout ride with us or come stop by and say hi.
Yeah, so thanks. Great.
See you guys down the road.